Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Costura.
And this weekly segment is a special segment because we're going to be covering down on our Q1 reporting for what we've talked about for this first quarter of 2026. So with that, Tom, do you want to kind of give an intro to what we got to talk about?
Yeah, so we did a report, kind of a live show at the beginning of the year that went over everything that we talked about in 2025, just basically pulling all the data that we had that we markered from all of the reporting we did through the show through the whole year. And we thought that that turned out really well. So what we're trying to do with the show is to do this on a quarterly basis, just kind of have a summary of, you know, a collection of 3 months and all the things we've talked about in the same kind of data set format, and then just, you know, kind of see what that data tells us. So, you know, kind of starting it off and looking at what we're looking at in scope here. So just some key data points that are going to be on the surface just to start as we kind of work through this. And we'll just kind of drive through the report. And this report will be released to everyone, hopefully alongside the podcast show, but we're still working on some of the details there. But the goal is to get this report out quarterly to everyone. So hopefully you all find it useful and beneficial. And yeah, so the data set that we're looking at for this quarter, we had 36 articles that we discussed throughout all the shows from the beginning of the year. That actually turned in and translated into covering down on 37 different MITRE techniques, 15 different actors, activity that targeted 24 different industries. And one of the things that we're doing in the background is trying to find different ways to scrape out the data that we might be able to talk about to provide more of that value to the practitioners on the listening end. One of the new cool data points I thought was interesting that we built in, Scott, is the 104 command artifacts that we've stripped out of all of that. So a lot of activity in Q1. Yeah. So what does that all mean, right? So, you know, we're kind of breaking that down, Scott, and kind of working through that. So what are some of the themes that we've seen, right? So top categories, things that we've seen through the year. You know, I'll start with the first one. This one should seem really, really obvious to folks, but it does matter, right? So we want to listen to the data. When we're looking at the kind of observed threats and themes, the malware specifically, so that category in itself can be a whole abundance of things, but we did, and there is a bunch of stuff that is bunched into that given category. That stood out above everything else, right? Malware as itself. So moving like past social engineering, past vulnerability stuff, past specific techniques, it's the general topic and conversation of malware as a whole. And I think that reflects, Scott. So when I kind of harken back to some of the articles we had, because when I initially seen this data point, I was like, okay, yeah, that's obvious, right? Malware's a thing. But when we look at why that number's high and we look at the associate stuff that we talked about, one of the things that I pulled away, Scott, was the evolution of the malwares that we were seeing, right? So things that we've talked about before for groups that, you know, APT groups as an easy low-hanging fruit, the evolutions of the malwares that are occurring that we've seen occurred just within this first 3 months of the year. Different ransomware groups. Gentleman ransomware is a good one to throw on this bucket. The malware that's being leveraged and the stuff that's being adapted to achieve the goals from these adversaries, it's evolving fast. And I don't know necessarily what that's tied to, right? I mean, I think we can take a couple minutes and assume, you know, maybe it's the targets and the things they're going after. Maybe it's, you know, collaboration amongst adversaries. You know, all these things tend to lean to true. Maybe it's the adaptation of AI and helping streamline this process. But it was a deal that initially I wanted to throw away, Scott, but I thought it was worth leaving in here.
Yeah, I feel like the malware, you know, from a category or a threat category is high, kind of because of the reporting we look for. You know, we always look for with this show, any kind of open source reporting that has technical detail, right? So you find yourself a lot when you look at news items for breaches and things, it's not technical. It doesn't often talk about malware a lot, but oftentimes when you have technical reports, it's associated with some sort of malware in general or tool sets that are being leveraged by an actor or a criminal or whatever. And, you know, with ransomware still kind of being a thing, with some of the, you know, geopolitical stuff going around in its current state, there's a lot kind of malware being, you know, utilized and thrown around pretty commonly. So kind of just makes sense based on the reporting we typically target and what people are willing or have to talk about as well. So, that stood out as a pretty obvious reason, I think. But what was cool, like when you talked about the evolution of malware, the one thing I like seeing is there was a lot of different malware being discussed throughout the first quarter, but a lot of shared behaviors amongst that malware. So it being the top topic, but knowing that it's utilizing some of the similar techniques. And I want to say, like, I can't remember 100% off the top of my head, but we covered some like sophisticated malware where you look at the malware reports and they went really hard on not being detected. But in a few of those episodes, we kind of would joke like, man, they went through all these hurdles to, you know, be able to bypass things and then avoid detection here and there. But then they, you know, as an example, use like a register run key for persistence or something, some nuanced technique that it was just everyone seems to use and it's easily identifiable, even though everything else you might not be able to see from a telemetry perspective. I feel like that was a kind of a common thing too with a lot of the various malwares, especially the more complex ones as well.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, and that kind of walks into one of the things we've seen, you know, again, and this is, I don't expect this to change and I expect us to echo it probably routinely. So however the listeners want to get at us with it, but it's worth it to constantly talk about the things that are, especially when we're threat hunters and we care about the telemetry and the stuff that we can see. But the living off the land side of the house, I think, flows right into exactly what you're talking about with the malware, right?
Yeah.
The techniques that are common that we're seeing are manipulating or leveraging those living off the land techniques. We're seeing the adaptation of different adversaries and their tool sets, how the malware is being leveraged, deployed, how it adjusts, things like that. But it almost always finds its way right back to that core root of the tree, the living off the land leveraging, because of all of the reasons that most should know about, right? Living off the land is going to allow for that ease of use, that simplicity of execution, the flying under the radar and evading defenses, using tool sets so you don't have to bring your own, right? Manipulating what's already on board on the target. And it's just, you know, because it was a big takeaway from the end of the year last year, but it's just, I just feel so strongly about making sure that it doesn't find its way to the wayside, because it's always talked about, because it's just so important. And often in this specific category, in the living off the land space, at least my opinion, Scott, is where you are going to find the bad guy the majority of the time when you're hunting. Please correct me if you think I'm wrong there.
No, one of the things that I think came up weekly that we talked about, or that I always at least tried to talk about, was the script interpreter chaining activity, right? Where you have either command prompt, PowerShell, WScript, or whatever, basically calling each other or executing each other in that type of chain, which is not traditionally common. In general, that always seemed to be a very common tradecraft, which is 100% living off the land, right? Even, you know, kind of jumping ahead, but when we look at MITRE techniques, one of the things I always find interesting as a technique of why it's considered that, you know, the T1059001, which refers to like PowerShell usage, you know, it kind of dawned on me, because I used to always hate that they had command prompt had its own technique, PowerShell, and it was like, what do you do with that? But when you actually look at things like a quarterly report or an annual report, and you see, is there one command script interpreter or command interpreter that bubbles to the top when you look at reporting, it's more commonly used. I think that's a good indicator of what do attackers typically lean on or have an easier time using or have more success using. And in our case, you know, when we get to the MITRE technique data at the bottom, PowerShell is the only one that shows to the top the list, right? Which is a strong indication that, you know, PowerShell is something that we need to have the right telemetry collected on and the right visibility to an understanding in your environment about, maybe more than the others, even though the other ones might be rare, so maybe they're easy to identify. Or easier potentially, but that's just an example of looking at, well, what do I focus even when it comes to living off the land? As a good point there. But yeah, the living off the land is, it's not going away, because living off the land, technically you're also using what administrators can use to do their job, which is highly effective, in just about everything.
Yeah. And just to echo, back to what I kind of started off on, kind of, you know, leading the, what the report stuff that we pull, what the data points are that we pulled. You know, we don't, when we're researching for the show, we do not go out and look for specific things. We're looking for stuff that we believe would be interesting to talk about, dig through, share with the audience, right? Kind of leading into that space of threat hunting and how to go find the bad and all of those things. And these data points are, you know, this is where I love the power of them, because we're talking about living off the land, not because we went and searched for it, just because it's constant and appears, right? Yeah, execution chain. And not to, again, not to get into stuff that it's coming down further down the report, but you mentioned the chained executions. Just the one of the most recent ones that has been relative to the supply chain stuff with the Axios NPM compromise, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you see it in there. You got Node executing command cmd.exe that kicks off Cscript that kicks off cmd.exe, right?
Yeah.
Weird, crazy chains that the payloads are executing, leveraging, you know, binaries on the system. So, yeah, it's constant. And, you know, I think you did make a point there at the end, and it's got me thinking kind of live fire, Scott, where people generally don't know where to go with living off the land techniques. Like, if you just say it as a general thing, if you were to tell a novice practitioner, a new hunter, or a junior analyst or something like that, like, hey, I want you to go after living off the land, and they're like, okay, deer in the headlights, what would be your next step of guidance to them if you were saying that? Like, what would you point folks in to look at if you said living off the land? What would be your top hitters?
I mean, the top hitters would be all the script interpreters. There's a lot of tools that are used for like discovery and things like that, but they're so specific, and the capability is very limited to like a very skewed scope. But looking at, you know, your command prompt, looking at your PowerShell, WScript, MSHTA, Cscript type activity, I think is beneficial, because part of understanding living off the land is understanding how it's actually legitimately used as well. And by looking at that, you kind of get a feel for what are your administrators and how's your environment set up to get familiar with that kind of activity. And you learn a lot by like, well, what is this? And as you try to investigate that, you understand how these tools can be used and why your organization is using these tools, which just matures you that much faster, so that when you start seeing things that are weird, they stand out even more, and you can immediately associate it with, well, this behavior has nothing to do with the objectives that the administrators typically use this stuff for. So I think that's just a good way. And that's where anything that involves being able to execute something is always a goal of adversaries, because that's kind of what they need to leverage. And that's why a lot of times those are used to execute something, to download something or whatever it is. A lot of the other lay of the land type binaries, they're leveraged, and if they're not primarily used for execution, that's very niche. And then it really depends on if it's just part of the playbook or need of the adversary, versus script interpreters are essential for almost all of them.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. I'd probably go simple, like simpler. Well, not simpler necessarily, but more narrowed. If like I had a young analyst come up to me and like, hey, what do I go after for living off the land? First question I would ask, are you in a Windows environment, right? Second thing I would say, PowerShell. Yeah. PowerShell everything. Like, just go after PowerShell right away, because it's so heavily leveraged in basically every Windows environment, and the vast majority of malware and payload delivery stuff we've seen, techniques that are used even hands-on keyboard, and we're not just talking about from executing stuff. Leveraging PowerShell to manipulate systems, right? To do system or network discovery, audit policies, change registry, deploy payloads with
obfuscation, right? And PowerShell and Coda commands, one we say all the time, right? And it's used.
Yeah.
It's because it's used everywhere. And that's one that I would definitely go after. So, you know, before we kind of move into the MITRE thing, I just wanted to hit on one more point in this area. So something that I thought was interesting, Scott, and I'm not intentionally trying to be vague here, but I did think it might be worth a couple seconds of talking about. So one of the things that I noticed when we looked through the social engineering flashpoint in our kind of observed threats buckets, right? Social engineering was number two on the list. Really, the thing here is not that it's something that's net new. It's not something that we don't already know about, right? But historically, from my perspective, we've always looked at social engineering typically from like a phishing standpoint, right? Mm-hmm. But we're seeing a lot of other ways that people are going about the social engineering side, right? You know, you have all your different variants of ClickFix. You have the, you know, the DPRK remote IT workers fiasco, right? You have all these other different things that occur in the social engineering space. So that made me start thinking, okay, well, is there a general goal that we see from the stuff that we've seen talked about or in that social engineering bucket relative to the data that we've talked about? And the one thing that I was able to pull out was the heavy focus on the valid account stuff, right? So to gaining access to the account distinctively, not trying to deliver something to a system, but with the focus on getting access to accounts was pretty high up there. And again, that may not seem strange to anyone, but I definitely think it's worth mentioning because of all of the variants that you put inside of a, and I'm going to air quote this, social engineering bucket, the why or the what they're going after can lead you to a lot of breadcrumbs to what you should consider hunting, protecting, detecting, and so on. And to see that the abundance of this space was relative to a very focused goal on not delivering a payload, but gaining access to accounts. I thought stood out to me, Scott.
Even when you looked at some of the payloads that are now being more delivered, you have more stealer activity.
Mm-hmm.
Then I think you normally see. So like there is a huge drive, and I think that even lends itself to some of the stuff we'll be talking more later on, like the supply chain and why that is so important and a huge driver there. But yeah, that's like the click fix thing that keeps coming up, and we always talked about it. And we even talked about it on the last episode when I made my, you know, a hypothesis of associating the birthing of that technique from the whole CrowdStrike issue where they were convincing people to how to do a Windows update and getting people to copy MSI type commands to run a package that was malware by taking advantage of that kind of same approach. Like, trust us, we have a fix for something that may be broken, just copy and paste and run this. And now we have tons of click fix stuff since then happening all over the place. Yeah, so it's one of those things that I think it kind of evolves, but then it doesn't. We did see a lot of some of the social engineering from even a phishing perspective where they're going back to using macros all over again, which happened a lot, which surprised us because, you know, I was thinking that would kind of die out knowing that Windows by default is now disabling those. But there must be some organizations that relied on it as a capability. So that is purposely enabled. But even there was some malware, I remember even looking at some malware that was hitting Ukraine where part of the attack was enabling the macro so they can be leveraged again. So I think that's also interesting too. When we talk about new social engineering, the fact that even the old techniques we can't completely forget about. Just because we think the problem should be somewhat remediated. That surprised me this quarter as well.
Yeah, for sure. But I think that, you know, that goes to something, and let's kind of like use that as a pivot point to go into the MITRE attack stuff that we've seen, because the MITRE stuff is really a good bucket to put things under. We do talk MITRE because it's a great way to classify, and the framework really helps make sense of things a lot of times, right? Excuse me. And, you know, to echo back into that, you know, we talk about some of the same things a lot, I think, Scott. And I,
yeah,
there was like a point in time, Yeah, it's like a broken record. And it was a point in time where I was like, okay, am I just repeating this to repeat it, or am I really, you know, trying to challenge myself? Am I repeating it just to repeat it, or am I actually thinking about this in the right way? And you know, just a little kind of short story, like working with folks in the industry, even in recent months, and having conversations when we're breaking down different threats and we're talking about, you know, what's a hunt for, or what a specific adversary or actor or threat is, what their behaviors are, what kind of techniques are they using. And you start talking about things that start sounding basic, right? When you're talking to someone in another place, it's like, yeah, ransomware groups, volume shadow copy deletions, right? Or access. Okay. Yeah. Pretty common, right? Should make sense. Right. And then you start kind of looking at it, and it's got me to the point where, you know, you have these conversations like, yeah, like, of course that is, like, yeah, of course that is, but are we looking for it? Are you tracking it? Are you considering it? Or because it seems so automatic, are we almost like maybe trusting a tool, or are we maybe a little too passive on it? And that's helped me center personally with us repeating this stuff, because what you realize and what you see is, one, obviously the stuff's still being used. And it's still being used because it still works. So whatever tooling system or things that are out there that folks might trust, you have to understand these things are still being used everywhere. So the ones that we repeat are constant. But I think the other challenge is to the practitioner side of, don't forget to consider them just because they seem like it's a no-brainer. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean,
I was going to say, like, why I like working with people with different experience levels, because sometimes you have your junior guy that will overcomplicate things, but sometimes you have the senior guy, because they understand more, will overcomplicate things, and they'll figure out how to, like, oh, we can, you know, detect or identify this by looking for all these different things and put them all together. Or you can have that one person just like, why can't we just look for this? They do this every time. And you're like, well, yeah, but that means, who knows, that's like too easy. Like that might not actually work. There might be too much noise or whatever, but like sometimes it really is just look for the easy stuff first, you know?
Yep.
I think, you know, you and I have had experience in this, is even if it's a penetration test or a real incident, you just got to find that first thing, and all your training will fall into place once you have something to like attach to then, you know, pivot from to investigate. The hardest thing is there's no training that prepares you for always finding that first thing, right? So that's why I think it's so important, even if something might not be the best or most sophisticated detection or identification, it doesn't mean it doesn't have a tremendous amount of value. It just might not paint the picture on, like, well, you know, we like to say this alert happened and it can tell us exactly who it is, exactly how it's affecting us, and, you know, all the information around it. That's just not a reality in those cases, right? Sometimes you'll find some random weird alert, like this account signed in 3 times. You're like, well, what does that mean? Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Like, who knows? And then you look and you're like, oh, but now it's from like actually like a different location, or it looked like some other event happened around that where something changed and then this happened. Like, you know, that's kind of what being a security professional is being able to find that loose thread and then pull on it.
Yeah. And I think that's the core of really kind of evolving yourself. And I'm guilty of it, because I've done, you know, detection engineering. I've done the security engineering side. I've sat at the desk in the SOC and done the analyst work at variant levels. And I am guilty of going into that mindset of trying to go at this complex attack path, right?
You want the pretty bow.
I want the pretty bow. I want to be able to be as pinpoint, you know, I want to be a sniper, right? I want to be a sniper. But sometimes you don't need to. Most times you don't need to. And this is really more towards folks that are coming up through their career set, the junior folks, but even folks that have been here for a while, because I still have to check myself and I've been doing it for over a decade, right? And I'm sure it's the same for you, Scott. We got to check ourselves, simplify, and ask questions. I think those two things really make sense. This is why we're like, hey, they're still doing, right? Walking into the MITRE stuff that we're going to talk about, like the top hitter out of the data that we have, the number one thing that we've seen that was the specific, like areas in a specific level of technique that we constantly repeat
is looking at those persistent mechanisms where you have that auto start execution, the boot log on auto start execution stuff, the register run keys, you know, your persistence mechanism.
Regardless holders, yeah.
Constant. We talk about it all the time, and there's a reason. 14 out of the 36 articles that we talked about all included this technique. So almost half of everything that we discussed had this technique involved in it. So when you look at this as a very simple thing, but you can start saying, okay, is this normal for my environment by just looking for that simple thing, right? And you can uncover right away something that so many people are using. But yeah, you know, kind of tossing it over to you, Scott, what were some of the techniques and some of the data pieces here that stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on the big one, right? The persistence piece. Like I always say that my favorite things to hunt for are persistence and execution. Just because they're the things that almost always happen early in the attack chain for one, typically. And they're also activity usually leaves the most telemetry versus some of the other types of, behaviors sometimes. And, you know, so like you hit on like the boot or log and auto start stuff with either startup folders, register run keys. Obviously 1/3 of the stuff we talked about was leveraging PowerShell in some way. Out of those articles and things that we covered, I don't think we saw a ton of it, but I know we saw it was the DLL side loading stuff. I think we had like a couple like hot weeks where it seemed to happen like really hot in some weeks and then kind of went a little cold. But yeah, I mean, DLL side loading is kind of an easy find when you know what to look for. And that's a good example of solving a problem with a simple solution that isn't, 100%, you know, true to the activity, but you know, seeing the executable and DLL writes of those files together within a directory that's not like a program file directory, within a small window of time, it likely that executable is going to use that DLL, and if it's that's something that's being how it got there is really important, it's likely DLL side loading. You know, the scheduled tasks and jobs, another persistent piece. We didn't see it as much as I kind of expected to see it, I guess, in the first quarter. But it was almost like there's very few times I want to say they use that and the register run keys. But if there weren't register run keys, there was definitely scheduled tasks. So I feel like that kind of offset where there was the gaps with the register run key stuff for persistence. And there was some COM object manipulation stuff for execution that kind of falls in the modify registry section. So that still happens and some adversaries still use that. That was about 3 out of the 32 or 30, is it 32 or 36 sources? 36 sources. 36. So yeah, that, you know, shows some form of execution via COM object and how that's being leveraged. So yeah, I typically focus on those. Obviously there's a lot of the stuff we covered because they're being published, right? They're always, in a lot of cases showing impact. So they're going to be showing like, you know, there's C2 and there's going to be showing exfiltration, sometimes, you know, ransom or encryption type activity. But yeah, the persistence and execution stuff, I think is near the top when it comes to MITRE techniques, because even if we do cover a source, if they can't determine the impact, or maybe, you know, they were able to, like, you know, sometimes the open source articles come from vendors, right? And they kind of are flaunting, well, we stopped the attack, but this is what we learned. So you don't really get to the impact side. So it explains why a lot of these probably lean more towards persistent execution. But I also feel like that's the best place to look anyways, or at least start looking. So yeah,
right. Those techniques are typically always in the bag, right?
Yeah.
Even groups or, you know, specific groups or actors that typically might not use them, right? Like I think we did on our live podcast, we were talking about Luma Stealer, right? So there's a good portion of Luma Stealer activity that doesn't carry that along, but it's not always, right? A lot of times it will, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, kind of in the data point with the MITRE stuff too, one of the things that I thought also stood out, and it's kind of harkening back to what we were talking about with the social engineering side, 11 out of 36 articles were carried along with them the use of valid accounts to accomplish the, you know, the compromises or the attack. And I just think that speaks to, you know, kind of the way of things now. And, you know, again, we're going to walk into some supply chain compromise stuff that's going to, you know, bring more of that up. But it was another data point that might seem obvious, but it stood out to me because I think when you put these pieces together, you're seeing a trend that could give you actionable stuff, right? You can really start considering what I might want to look for, of how people are leveraging things, how I might want to consider accounts in my environment. Maybe there's ways to, you know, to consider, okay, I have accounts that can do X, Y, and Z. Maybe it helps drive, maybe this like kind of trending points that we're talking about helps you think about, maybe I want to assess my environment for what accounts can access what, profile them, put them in a bucket, let's know my environment a little better so I can think about where the big pain points would be if or when something like this were to occur, right? That kind of like always consider yourself compromised, like in that logic path, right? But that stood out to me. 11 out of 36 articles all were leveraging valid accounts and, you know, things that we understand and know, like the underground's heavy with that. I mean, it's a full market to both steal accounts, sell accounts, reuse accounts, and so on.
Yeah. I had like a thought on that, and it's not something that's going to be like a near-term problem, but obviously the valid accounts, we see the effectiveness of it. And if you think about the more and more we move to, you know, digital identities in general, like we didn't start building our own digital identities because the internet emerged, you know, in our lifetime. Think about the younger generations, when you kind of think forward another 10 to 20 years, they all have digital identities that they have created with no security mindset at all. And unless organizations are helping them secure or do things in a smart way with those digital identities, they're going to be prime for attack for that kind of stuff 20 years from now. And these might be the same people that are working in organizations that, you know, depending on how exposed their digital footprint is beforehand, there's more exposure potential there, I think. So I think valid accounts is going to be an ever-growing problem. It's not going to be one that shrinks anytime soon, just because I think of that natural transition of people growing up with digital identities since they're like, you know, just being able to walk.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, with the way that is, and if I could throw out, you know, a wrench into fixing the problem or something, yeah, and a hammer into fixing the problem, like in the industry as a whole, understanding that point of like what, not just what your footprint might be, but also like what you are, or at least in your environment, understand what people have access to. It screams with the way that's being leveraged, with the way the digital footprints are not slowing down, right? Not even the youth, but even in our standpoint, all of the different places we have to have a presence or a digital identification of some sort, right? It's not hard to go on LinkedIn and profile somebody that works at a place that's talked about all they did and understand what tooling they might be using and put together a whole potential engineering, their social engineering practice to target them to get the access to do the thing, right? It's not hard to do that stuff, and it's getting more complex as far as how much footprint is out there. So coming back home inside of the house to consider, well, who can unlock the door?
Right. Yeah. And a lot of these accounts that are getting compromised are not because domain controllers are getting compromised more, right?
Nope.
I think that's the scary thing. Before, it used to be, we got to protect the DC because that has the keys of the kingdom, that has everything. And it's like, no longer is that really the case anymore. Especially when you start looking at like developers and API keys and access tokens and all that kind of stuff, the single sign-on type stuff. There's so many things that allow access outside of that, even if it is just like you masquerading as somebody for access, or even applications have their own identity. So if you haven't figure out a way to get an application registered or people to register to your applications, I mean, like there's just so many ways. It's way more complex than some people realize for some of that stuff. So the valid account thing, yeah, it's going to be a growing problem until we really figure out how we want to manage identities in general in a more centralized fashion.
Yeah. And I, you know, historically, right, the
you know, basic passwords, change the complexity of the passwords, change the length of the passwords, because tools and, you know, techniques are being brought to crack those. And then you introduce, you know, MFA. MFA is still very good, very strong, but MFA has been worked around many, many different ways. That, right? He talked about applications, right? I mean, we've seen firsthand how applications can allow a lot of access to a lot of things and you just don't know it, right? Like giving full OAuth access to you know, to your account based off of random application that you installed on a phone, or clicking a text messages, or MFA fatigue, where you have to check a box or an alert that comes through an authenticator six times a day as you're logging into your systems, and that seventh time it hits and you're like, what? And you're just like, oh yeah, that's normal, and you just hit it and suddenly somebody's hijacked the session you have active. Like there's always a way around it, right? So it's like, not to stop considering the defenses, but yeah, the valid account thing screams to me, Scott. And I'm stuck in this like daydream world with this, from this data set and this report, of like, what are methods that people can consider to help themselves that they're not necessarily doing? Or maybe it's not standard. Maybe it's a little outside of the box, right?
Well, I mean, one of the things we should consider is when we report for Q2, how does that number change? You know?
100% already had that marked, because I am curious. I have questions. The trend stuff is fascinating to me personally. I love like seeing those abstract data points and what they might point to, right? At least interesting enough to ask a question and maybe dig a little more, right? That's what we do as analysts, is look for the weirdness and try to see what it means. Yeah.
Well, and another side note for the valid account thing is, in the historically, when you're a security person, you would look for a bunch of failed authentications with successfuls, right? To like look for account abuse. The thing with valid account stuff is there is none of that, right? So the traditional way for you to look at account abuse doesn't really go around the overt activity on a single account, good and bad. It's just a login that happens like every other login, because they already have it, you know? So traditional account monitoring isn't the same.
Right. All right. So, you know, we're kind of, you know, through a lot of the from a high level, a lot of the points that are in the report piece, but I kind of wanted to move into one of the sections for our report to kind of just touch on some of the heavy hitting topics for this quarter, right? So, you know, obviously we have, and this is something that I think is, it's more kind of how we sort of addressed it last month when we kind of talked on it. You know, uncertain geopolitical times tend to yield all kinds of chaos for our industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a place and a time where it's kind of utter chaos outside. And there's a lot going on. And with a lot going on, there's a lot of, you know, nation state conflicts. A lot of nations at conflict in different parts of the world. And when a lot of the nation states that have fundamentally and historically have had a lot of backing as far as their cyber capabilities, their various APT groups or the underlying hacktivist groups that might pair with them, right? A good example of that is, you know, a lot over the Iran conflict. We know that there's a ton of different stuff out there. We know that from history, right? We've had to cross swords with a lot of that stuff quite a bit in the different areas we've worked in the world, right, Scott?
Yeah.
So we're familiar with it. We know there's a ton out there, but you put this stuff in conflict and suddenly a lot of things start coming to light. A lot of people start prioritizing this. A lot of companies get worried that they may fall in sight relative to this conflict, because maybe they're an organization that could be an impactful target, right? And everything kicks up in these times. And it gets weird and it gets strange. And it was something that we didn't talk about in abundance, but there is certainly a lot happening, especially when we talk about what's going on in this quarter with this. We've seen, you know, one of the big ones, the Hamdallah situation, and the kind of the rise back up of awareness of that group and kind of what they are and how they interact with the Iranian nation state groups and kind of how they operate also to the side. And there's all kinds of stuff happening there and different targets that they're going after. And this type of space we've seen historically too, doesn't necessarily, you don't necessarily need to be a target that's in line. you might just be more accessible because your focus is elsewhere too. And I think that's something else that's kind of key to consider out of this. But yeah, so just kind of talking on this specific section, Scott, what are some thoughts you have there?
Yeah, so I thought this was interesting because we did kind of a similar exercise when the Russia-Ukraine war broke out. And it was about, well, how do we make sure that, you know, we're looking at all the Russian-based behaviors? What are some of the new things they're actually doing? And there's a distinct difference as far as you can see how the groups may be organized and how they operate. Because with the Russian side of the house, you still saw some delineation between the different, you know, groups and how they're classified from the Russian APT side, where they did kind of keep their SOPs, craft somewhat separate. There wasn't as much overlap. What's interesting about Iran is, there's a lot of overlap amongst the groups where sometimes the delineation, isn't as clear this time as we go through and look at a lot of the behaviors. And what's nice is a lot of the behaviors haven't really changed either. So that's the benefit of why we're, you know, threat hunting so effective for especially these like persistent type threats. But you know, that also goes back to, you know, even though there's these huge hitting topics of like, maybe there's a specific Iranian group you're concerned about, attribution might not be the most important thing to hyper focus on as it is just knowing this is like what Iran does for that versus the Russian side when we looked at that historically. So that was something that kind of stood out that I wouldn't have, I guess, come to that conclusion without kind of running through those two different exercises. It's just like, yeah, there are distinctions for how nations specifically operate, how they work with other underlying groups outside of just the their nation or government type entity. Also what it looks like when they don't have communication capabilities. Like, you know, that's similar to what you see with like North Korea. North Korea oftentimes doesn't operate out of North Korea for their cyber capabilities because they have a small IP space and they don't have all the same connectivity. So sometimes they operate actually out of China. Well, with the Iran stuff, we're seeing where there's a lot of places where they're operating out of different places or even coming from hijacked Starlink type connections for connectivity. Just because, you know, based on, you know, the types of strikes and attacks and displacement of stuff. So there's a lot of things that like kind of paying attention to are kind of interesting to see how it unfolds. But that was kind of my big takeaway that I thought stood out. But it's good to know that a lot of the techniques haven't changed a ton from what they traditionally done historically. But also it is really hard to draw those lines between, well, what group is it, you know, Iranian group. So
yeah, the attribution pieces, it can get difficult. It also can become a trap, and it's something that on attribution's great. I don't think it's a bad thing, but I think in the scope of priorities, especially if you're actively trying to protect an environment, the attribution will find its way. It should find its way, you know, near the back part of that, if it's important to you, if at all. But also too, you know, Scott, something that I think maybe is not considered enough. This is, you know, again, my perspective, my speculation, my own opinion here is when we're in kind of turbulent geopolitical times, a lot of times there are variant degrees, especially in a world that we live in where everybody's a lot more connected, right? Mm-hmm. Or variant degrees of viewpoints on what should be doing what, who should be doing what, and so on. So you tend to see, especially with the tool sets that are available now, activist side things can target stuff that fall out of line, not necessarily in a direct conflict, but maybe, you know, maybe an organization that supports idea A, but idea B is what the hacktivist group wants. So you become kind of a secondary or a third or some side target of a potential cyber threat that you might not have considered before because you were looking at who directly attacks me, right? Like maybe you're representing something that now, because of the geopolitical space, because of the turbulent conflicts, you may become a target of this from that side door. And as we've kind of watched this and we've gone through this practice with the different conflict stuff, like you brought up the Russian-Ukrainian thing, we've gone through some of these scenarios in our careers, some of them together, and they tend to go down that same line. And this time around with this, my head can't not think about what are the things that are going to hit us from the side versus the thing that we're totally expecting, you know? And it's just something that not necessarily hit a panic button on, but you should consider just kind of along that same lines of knowing your environment, knowing what accounts might be leveraged for a thing, just really understanding what your true attack surface is, not just a few systems that might be connected to the internet. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think you touched on a couple things. You know, I think one of the things to consider when it comes to geopolitical stuff and whether or not you kind of fall within the sights, it really depends on how, especially with conflicts, how they're going. Because if one side becomes more desperate, then their reticule is targeting a much broader set to try to have some sort of impact. So you might fall into that net because you're an easy target. You can be a huge eyepiece. You can add recognition or whatever. Increase morale the other side because they actually hit something, whatever it was, from a cyber perspective. So there's that piece. But then also, I like how you describe the attribution as a trap, because it just makes me think of, you know, former military concept. Like, you know, do I really care who's shooting at me if I'm being shot at? Not really. The urgency is I'm being shot at. I don't want to be shot at anymore. Right. Like, so, you know, I'd rather.
I hope so, right?
Right. Like, yeah. I'd rather just address that than ponder, like, I wonder, you know, if they're a strapping young man that's, you know, this specific height, or maybe they originated from, like, who cares? You know, like, if someone's coming after me, I just want them to stop. And sometimes I think getting ahead of that is where attribution is important. But in the midst of it, sometimes attribution is not as helpful. So yeah, know where to use attribution where it's most effective. And it's definitely not once you're attacked or while you're attacked. It's usually after the fact or before the fact. So make sure to keep that in scope.
Yeah, for sure. It looks great when you can, like,
yeah,
confidently achieve it and report that whole scope. It's a great summary, right? Like, you're able to put all the pieces together. So it's always fun to have that just in the fire. Yeah, it's not about who's shooting at you. It's about getting shot at. That's such a great analogy. I love that. Okay. All right. So, you know, one of the other big key points that we, you know, kind of working towards close out here, one of the other areas that were big parts of this quarter, and we've mentioned it already a few times, was supply chain side. You know, prior to building this, it seems obvious to me. I don't think I'm at all a Nostradamus, man. It's just where I was willing to put my money on the table. Like, the supply chain stuff makes sense of why it's being targeted and the ways that they're getting access, the valid account leveraging, the ability to steal with the malware and the stealers that are out there, and not just, you know, given accounts or cookies or browser sessions, but secrets, tokens, developer side things, CICD pipeline items, like stuff that can give access to the strings that hold up our whole internet situation, right? And our applications and all the interactions. It seems like a viable target, and the success rates that were occurring last year, it only made sense to say that was going to continue to be a place to go after. And we, you know, our report does mention on it, but we hadn't had a show yet where we were able to dive in on some of the big attacks that have happened in just the last couple weeks. So you have the stuff with the team PCP side, and then most recently you have the Axios NPM compromise.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy that so much has already happened in the first 3 months, right? Because even in the beginning of the year, we carried in some of that supply chain overflow that was still occurring with the nightmare, the N8N stuff that was going on the supply chain side, right? We're seeing even small articles and research. I know you've come across a few. I certainly have, Scott. Where it's just talking about leveraging compromised, like random one-off compromised PyPI packages or NPM packages that don't turn into a full-scale supply chain, but it's still in that space, right?
there's a lot to discuss here, man. So I'll kind of like, after that general summarization, I'm gonna want you to kick it off and tell me what you think about the supply chain stuff, where you want to, which topic you want to hit on first.
No, yeah. Like I said, that was interesting because we did our predictions at the end of last year when we did the year round thing, and you were big on the supply chain stuff because we kept seeing it. But like you said, it was like, you know, hit or miss, kind of random things that were interesting and of note. And it was, you know, kind of clever, but no major packages had been hit like the ones that we see here, especially with the Axios stuff, right? I mean, that's just like, their stuff's embedded in so many web dev type components. It's kind of everywhere. And it was, well, I think the most interesting thing is when it comes to like AI specific attacks, the only thing we've really seen from an AI perspective is how to steal credentials, like with the OpenClaw stuff and things like that. And not really around an overall attack, like people are still so worried about. Not saying it's not coming at some point, but it's just not the right thing to be concerned about at the moment. But with these, what's good to know, though, is the more advanced some of these attacks are getting, or like more well-developed, also is creating more telemetry, which I think is interesting. So like with the Team PCP one stuff, you know, they're leveraging Python a lot there with the later stages of the attack, and you have Python executing bash to do all sorts of discovery and all sorts of things there and executions. And you also have Python creating a subsystem of Python for those executions. So it's like that script interpreter chaining with Python kicking out Python and kicking out these other things like we talked about earlier. I think that's the good news, I guess, from the beforehand, the packages that were being leveraged or picked off from a supply chain perspective that weren't huge impacts. They weren't as well developed, so there wasn't that much activity. These ones showcase a lot of activity. So that's worth noting. The other thing, even when looking at some of the Axios stuff, and I mentioned this to you earlier, you know, we talked about supply chain and like, how do we deal with, you know, if we use packages as a developer or whatever, like what's the best defense, or, you know, what do you do about that? And we commonly talked about how that's one of the best use cases for an LLM is if you're worried about some sort of library or something, especially if it's open source, is it bad or is anything bad in it? LLMs can kind of help decipher some of that. And there's actually a guy who put together a supply chain monitor. It's under the Elastic repo in GitHub, and it's called Supply Chain Monitor, you know, hyphenated between the words. And he implemented a really cool way to monitor this. And I believe in the art blog where he was talking about the Axios stuff, I believe he implemented this or created this kind of process with the Team PCP stuff. And then it was able to identify the Axios issue. But basically, you understand from a supply chain and discovery for what, you know, libraries and things you may use. And this orchestrated, you know, automated fashion project he has here for supply chain monitor, it will download anytime there's a revision being published to a certain repo for the either the Python libraries or the npm libraries. It will download the previous version, the current version, create a diff of those to build a report to then submit to an LLM to do a review to say out of the changes anything look malicious essentially, and then if anything, if there is something, create a Slack alert because he's using Slack. That was just a great way to detect things. And so I think people should be looking at solutions like this. Now, granted, depending on what libraries you monitor, we talked about this earlier, there's some where there's a lot of revisions being pushed daily. So if you don't have the funding or the account set up for LLM to be able to do that analysis, you know, continuously, that might be a hurdle. But if you're really worried about this, this is kind of an elegant, at least band-aid solution, if anything, to help add some confidence to
your security stack.
Yeah, for sure. That tool is pretty cool. I'm glad you introduced me to that, because it's nice too, just to think that people are out there thinking about how to solve the problem, because that's what we really need right now, right? Because this space, I don't think, is going to slow down. And this, the Axios one in particular, I mean, honestly, both the Team PCP one and the Axios one. What I don't like is, I worry personally, this is hopefully not in lending in the places conspiracy, but I worry personally, they almost drowned out the need to consider things, right? And a lot of the basics that are inside of them. So like both, you get this kind of like when these happen, and it's not to short sell them, right? But like the Axios one in general, it's this big highlight, this big talk. You get a lot of the scary numbers that come along with the headline, and you don't necessarily look under the weeds to see what was accomplished, right?
Yeah.
When we talk about the Axios one, just to give a little bit of information that maybe some folks know, maybe they don't know, but you see where that valid account kind of direction, right? First hit the valid account side, because in my little soapbox here, I'm going to echo things that I've echoed a million times, but I'm trying to provide application to that. In the valid account, the individual who was leveraged, one of the developers maintainers who was leveraged, their account was leveraged to gain access to kick off this whole compromise. Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting kind of pathway, right? Like there were people that reached out to this individual and they kind of followed a very similar process to the historical things that ultimately centered back to a group, UNC 1069 that Google attributed this whole thing to. But they reached out to this individual masquerading as a founder of a company. They invited him to a true Slack workspace. They went through the whole idea. They showed, showed everything looked like it branded. Yeah, they did the whole thing. And, the individual got themselves into it, and then ultimately, found their way into it. Almost likely, and I don't know if it's been confirmed or not, Scott, if you know this, please correct me, but almost likely because of that process where they got into this place, they got into these meetings, they go into a digital meeting, they get that fake update where it's like, hey, your Teams or your Google Meet or whatever application they were on is like, hey, there's something wrong with it. Click this button to fix it. You click that button, suddenly you've installed a rat. Now they stole your stuff. And good chance that's exactly how it occurred. But then from there...
Finish your thought, but I've got something a hypothesis as far as like a potential threat that we have to probably be aware of.
Okay. All right. I'll try not to be long-winded, but from there, I just wanted to get under a couple more points there, Scott. But from there, when you kind of see how stuff was delivered once these packages were compromised and then the payloads that were associated with them, right? Like you see that they designed payloads that went after... multiple systems, right? So they had payloads for Windows, Linux, Mac, right? And all of them did the basic stuff. Mm. All of them had the basic telemetry markers that we constantly talk about, right? When you're looking at like the, just using the Windows one as an example, you're seeing some of the basic things that occur. You're seeing the PowerShell encoder commands. You're seeing the heavy and weird use of PowerShell. You're seeing the use of curl to pull payloads down from the internet. You're seeing the basic registry run key, and it's like this really kind of scary complex thing, and it is scary. The supply chain one should scare people, and they should be on alert, because what can happen because of these, we won't know for time. Like this isn't going to be an immediate reveal, like a single company being compromised, right? But it should give you some confidence that you can go and track this bad stuff if it were to occur, if you can't get ahead of that developer side, watching the packages, doing diffs, getting something in place there to have a system that does it. Go after the basics, and even these complex, very scary attacks are within your realm to mitigate. And that's just really the point I wanted to end on. Scott, go ahead with yours.
Yeah, I was just going to say, based on that whole attack path, right, where you have a developer that kind of gets groomed in order to get access to what they have access to, I think that's something that we probably will be at more risk for, if the economy is shifting or AI is replacing positions, people are likely to look for jobs or get that feeling they might lose their job. So they'll be more prone to look for these golden opportunities that may reach out to them or do something based on, and, you know, and that I think becomes a much more reliable attack path to target certain individuals for access that people should be thinking about. And that's kind of why being in, I think, cybersecurity or security in general, you can't just think about just that narrow focus of what you touch. There's so many influences outside of that that enable different attack paths, or especially with social engineering. Like, that's why there's tax specific stuff, you know, part of the year, Valentine stuff, the other part of the year. There's all sorts of different things. And you kind of have to be aware of these types of things to help predict where your risks are, because the risk changes based on almost time of year, or based on geopolitical tensions, or based on economic drivers or business change or acquisitions, you know. So those are things that I think, you know, you bring up that scenario here. I think that scenario will be likely something that will be more likely in the future.
100%. Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, Scott, just really wanted to touch, you know, kind of summarize up some of the key takeaways that we grabbed from reporting over Q1. You know, pay attention to living off the land. It's not changing. We mentioned it in the summary from last year. It's only emphasized itself already in the first 3 months. You know, really start thinking about, at least from your perspective on the defense side, you know, identity-centric visibility and ways to hunt in that space in the tooling and the telemetry that you have. Really start considering, because of the valid account usage, consider what accounts are doing in your environment. Start small. Start simple. You know, maybe look, you know, it's a very, very easy starter point that I might give. Consider your domain admins or someone that has really privileged stuff. Yes. You know, really look at entrenching your thought processes around the geopolitical climates and what's happening. Like, reassess what your percentage of target is for given things. That could help you a lot in prioritizing efforts and really, like, using the resources effectively that you're going to have, even all the way down to the single analyst and the time spent on screen where you might look to have the most effectiveness. Like, just consider those things. I also kind of bulleted in here too, you know, prioritizing those detections and hunts around those common and overlap behaviors. I'll probably scream it until somebody shuts me up, but it's proofed time and time again, and we'll keep applying that message to the proof, so everyone can understand, hey, it's here, it's still happening.
Yeah, I would say, like, every time we talk, 90% of the stuff we talk about is identified through just a few common things. So
they're worth it. They're worth it. They can at least give you some ammo in the fight, right? At a bare minimum, they can give you some ammo in the fight to help mitigate as best you can in whatever environment you're in. And that's not to say to not strive for those complex things. I still fall in love with some of the crazy novel behaviors that we see and want to figure out how to get them. It's great. So it's part of what I think drives our passion for this, right? But don't forget about the basics. Those are so important.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few bullets I had, Scott. Is there any other takeaways you want to toss alongside of this before we close out?
No, I mean, the only thing I know we didn't talk about that I like to talk about is single character file naming and executions. It still happened in Q1. It didn't overtly happen like it has in some of the other quarters and stuff. So, and the one thing I thought was interesting is, I say this quarter we actually saw the double character named file executions, which I thought was interesting. Like, I really feel like our biggest fan.
They're listening to you.
Yeah, I know. Like, I've got the fans, but not necessarily the ones I want, I guess. But yeah, so just noted that. But everything you said, I would just echo the same thing. You know, the things we harp on, we don't harp on it because we think it sounds cool or you know, when you need something to talk about. Like, that's stuff that we truly believe and we try to prove every week when we talk about it. We bring it up again and again because we're like, if you just do this, stomp, whatever the teachers do to get attention to students, it's good stuff. So,
yep. Awesome.
All right.
Well, I think that kind of closes out our Q1 review for 2026. So I really want to thank everyone for sticking around. I know this was probably a little longer, but we kind of dove into a lot of things. Hopefully you'll be able to see the report alongside this. You have something else to look at and read and take forward with you. So looking forward to syncing up next time. With that, that closes out our Q1 review of 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.